12. So little had changed since Wax's youth. Oh, the people at this party wore slightly different clothing. Formal waistcoats had grown stouter, and hemlines had risen to mid-calf, while necklines had plunged, with mere bits of gauze draping across the neck and down the shoulders. The people, though, were the same. They weighed him, calculating his worth, hiding daggers behind ready smiles. He met their condescending nods and didn't miss his guns as much as he would have thought. Those were not the right weapons for this fight.
"I used to be so nervous at these things," Wax said softly to Steris. "When I was a kid, that was when I still cared about their opinions, I guess, before I learned how much power over a situation you gain when you decide that you don't care what others think of you."
Steris eyed a couple of passing ladies in their completely laceless gowns.
"I'm not certain I agree. How you are perceived is important. For example, I'm regretting my choice of gown. I was shooting for fashionable, but fashion is different down here. I'm not in style. I'm avant-garde."
"I like it," Wax said. "It stands out."
"So does a pimple," Steris said. "Why don't you get us some drinks, and I'll take stock of the room and figure out where our targets are."
Wax nodded in agreement. The grand ballroom was carpeted and adorned with golden chandeliers, though their candle holders glowed with electric lights. The ceiling wasn't terribly high, but the walls were colorfully decorated with false archways that each held a mural. Classical pieces, like the ascendant warrior rising above a flock of ravens, the typical depiction of the Lord Ruler's wraiths, of whom only Death himself remained. Though nobody approached him, they also didn't avoid him. If anything, they remained determinedly in his path, refusing to budge, then acted like they hadn't noticed him as he wove around them. He was from Ellendale, their political enemy, and in not moving they made a statement. Rusts, he hated these games. The bar covered almost the entire length of the far wall and was serviced by at least 24 bartenders, so as to make absolutely certain none of the very important guests had to wait. He ordered wine for Steris and a simple gin and tonic for himself, which got him a raised eyebrow. Apparently that wasn't fancy enough. Should have ordered straight-up whiskey. He turned and scanned the room as the bartender prepared the drinks. Soft music by a harpist helped cover the many conversations. It made him uncomfortable to admit that some of the casual discussions in a room like this could do more to affect the lives of the Basin's people than putting any criminal, no matter how vile, in prison.
"Miracy is always talking about things like that," he thought. "How the law-keeping of the future will be about statistics, not shotguns."
He tried to imagine a world where murders were prevented by careful civic planning, and found himself unable to see it. People would always kill. Still, sometimes it was hard not to feel like the one chandelier in the room that still required candles. "Your order, my lord," the bartender said, setting the drinks down on fancy cloth napkins, each embroidered with the date of the party. Those would be for the attendees to take as keepsakes. Wax fished a coin from his pocket for a tip and slid it to the bartender. He grabbed his drinks to head back to Steris, but the bartender cleared his throat. The man held up the coin, and it was not a 5-spin as Wax had meant to give him. In fact, it was unlike any coin Wax had ever seen.
"Was this a mistake, my lord?"
the man asked.
"I don't mean to be ungrateful, but I'd hate to take something that looks like a memento."
The symbols on that coin, Wax thought, stepping back to the bar. "They're the same as the ones on the walls and the pictures Relor took." He nearly overturned the wine glass of another guest in his haste to grab the coin back. He absently shoved the bartender another tip and held up the coin. Those were the same symbols, or very similar, and it had a face on the back, that of a man looking straight outward, one eye pierced by a spike. The large coin was made of two different metals, an outside ring and an inner one. The coin certainly didn't seem old. Was it new, or merely well-preserved? Rust and ruin, how had this gotten into his pocket?
"The beggar tossed it to me," Wax thought.
But where had he gotten it? Were there more of these in circulation? Troubled, he struck out to find Steris. As he walked, he passed Lady Calasina, the party's hostess, and the woman who was his eventual target. The older woman stood resplendent in a gown of black and silver, holding miniature court before a group of people asking after one of her civic projects. Wax listened in for a moment, but didn't want to confront the woman yet. He eventually located Steris, standing beside a tall, thin table near the corner. There weren't any chairs in the ballroom, no dancing either, though there was a dance floor raised an inch or two in the center of the chamber. Wax set the coin on the table and slid it to Steris.
"What's this?" she asked.
"The coin that the beggar threw at me. Those symbols look similar to the ones in the pictures Relure took."
Steris pursed her lips, then turned the coin over and looked at the other side.
"A face with one eye spiked through. Does it mean something?"
"No idea," Wax said. "I'm more interested in how that beggar got it, and why he threw it at me. It has to be a relic Relure found at that temple. Could he have lost it, or traded it to someone in the city?"
He tapped the table with one finger, certain now that beggar had been something more than he pretended. He was equally certain that if he went hunting now, he'd find that the man had vanished. Eventually, Wax pocketed the coin.
"We have to hope that the answers are in this room somewhere, assuming Calasina really is involved."
"Then it's time to get to work."
"I passed her back there. Shall we?"
"Not yet. See that couple over there? The man has on a maroon waistcoat."
Wax followed her nod. The couple she indicated were young, well-dressed, and smug. Great.
"That is Lord Gave Entron," Steris said. "Your houses have had some minor business dealings. He's in textiles, which should give you an opening to speak with him."
"I've heard of him," Wax said. "I courted a cousin of his once. It went poorly."
"Well, he's also on the list your mad Chandra made in his notebook, so he might know something. He's young, dynamic, and well-regarded, but not terribly important, so he'll work nicely as a first try."
"Right," Wax said, eyeing Entron, who had drawn a crowd of several more young women as he told a story that involved lots of gesturing. He took a deep breath. "You want to take the lead?"
"It should be you."
"You sure? I can't help feeling I'd be better put to use with Maracy and Wayne digging in graves, while you are comfortable here. You're good at these things, Steris, you really are. And don't give me any more of your rhetoric about being boring."
Her expression grew distant.
"In this case, it's not that I'm boring, it's more that I'm off. I've learned to fake being normal, but lists of prepared comments and jokes can only take me so far. People can sense that I'm not being authentic, that I don't like the things they like or think the way they do. Sometimes it amazes me that people like Wayne, or even those Chandra, can be so startlingly human when I feel so alien."
He wished he could figure out how to keep her from saying things like that. He didn't know the right words. Every time he tried to argue the point, it only seemed to make her withdraw. Steris held out an arm to him. He took it, and together they crossed the room toward Lord Gave and the small crowd he had drawn. Wax had worried about how to break into the conversation, but as soon as he neared, the people talking to Gave stepped back and made room for him. His reputation and status had preceded him, apparently.
"My Lord Waxillium," Gave said with a knowing smile, "I was delighted when I heard that you were going to attend our little gathering. I've wanted to meet you for years."
Wax nodded to him, then to his date and a couple he'd been chatting with. Those two didn't retreat.
"How are you finding New Saren, my lord?"
one of the ladies asked him.
"Seems mighty inconvenient to get around," Wax said. "Nice otherwise, though."
They laughed at that, as if he'd said something humorous. He frowned. What had he missed?
"I'm afraid," Gave said, "you won't find much to interest you here. New Saren is a quiet city."
"Oh, but what were you saying, Lord Gave?"
the other young man said.
"Don't misrepresent our town. The nightlife here is fantastic, Lord Waxillium, and the symphony has been given a citation of excellence by two of your previous governors."
"Yes," Gave said, "but there aren't many shootouts."
The others gave him blank stares.
"I was a lawman, Wax told them, in the roughs. One of the ladies said.
You oversaw a city's constable precinct?
No, he was a real lawman, Gabe said. The ride-a-horse-and-shoot-bandits type. You should read the accounts. They're all the rage in the Ellendale broadsheets.
The three others regarded him with bemused expressions.
How unique,
one of the ladies finally said.
The accounts are exaggerated, Styris said quickly. Lord Waxillium has only been directly responsible for the deaths of around 100 people, unless you include those who died of infection after he shot them. I'm still not sure how to count those.
It was a difficult life, Wax said, looking toward Gave, who smiled behind his cup of wine, eyes twinkling. For a man like him, Wax and Styris were obviously good sport. But that is behind me now. Lord Gave, I wanted to thank you for our years of mutually profitable trade.
Oh, don't bring business into it, Lord Waxillium, Gave said with a tip of his wine. This is a party.
The others laughed. Again, Wax had no idea why. Damn, he thought, looking between them. I am rusty. He'd complained, dragged his feet, but he hadn't expected to be this clumsy. Focus. Gave knew something about the bands of mourning, or at least Relor had thought he did.
Do you have any hobbies, Lord Gave? Wax asked, earning an eager nod from Styris at the comment.
Nothing of real note, Gave said.
He loves archaeology,
his date said at the same time, though. He gave her a dry look.
Archaeology, Wax said. That's hardly unnotable, Lord Gave.
He loves relics, the lady said. Spends hours at the auction house snatching up anything he...
I like history, Gave interjected. Artworks from times past inspires me. But you, dear, are making me sound too much like one of those gentleman adventurers.
He sneered at the term.
I'm sure you saw the type up in the roughs, Lord Waxillium. Men who'd spend their lives in society but suddenly decided to go off seeking some kind of thrill or another where they didn't belong.
Styris stiffened. Wax met the man's gaze levelly. The insult, veiled though it was similar to those he'd suffered in Ellendale society.
Better they try something new, Wax said, as opposed to wasting their lives in the same old activities.
My Lord Waxillium, Gabe said, disappointing one's family is hardly original. People have been doing it since the days of the last emperor.
Wax made a fist at his side. He was accustomed to insults, but this one still got under his skin. Perhaps it was because he was on edge, or perhaps it was because of his worry about his sister. He pushed down his anger, Styris squeezing his arm, and tried another tactic.
Is your cousin well?
Valette? Most certainly. We are all pleased with her new marriage. I'm sorry your relationship didn't work out, but the man who courted her after you was dreadful. When titles are part of a union, it's always unpleasant to see what crawls out from the mists looking for a bone.
He didn't look at Styris as he said it. He didn't need to. That sly smile, so self-satisfied as he sipped his wine.
You rat, Wax growled. You rusting, spineless rat.
He reached for his gun, which, fortunately, wasn't there. The other three young nobles looked to him, shocked. Gave grinned in a cocky way before adopting an expression of outrage.
Excuse me, he said, turning his date by the arm and striding away.
The others scuttled after. Wax sighed, lowering his arm, still angry.
He did that deliberately, he muttered. Didn't he?
He wanted an excuse to leave the conversation, so he insulted me. When that didn't work, he flung one at you, knowing I'd overreact.
Styris said. Yes, you have the right of it.
Styris nodded. Other people nearby made conversation, but they left an open space around Wax and Styris.
I'm sorry, Wax said. I let him get to me.
That's why we tried him first, Styris said. good practice. And we did learn something. The archaeology comment prodded too close to something he didn't want to discuss. He turned to veiled insults to distract us.
Wax took a deep breath, shoving away his annoyance at this entire situation. What now? Do we try another one?
No,
Steris said, thoughtful.
We don't want our targets to know that we're approaching them specifically. If you interact with unaffiliated people in between, our pattern will be more difficult to spot.
Right, Wax said, looking through the busy hall as the harpist retreated and a full band, with brass, something you'd never see at a party in Ellendale, began setting up instruments in her place. He and Steris sipped drinks as the music started. Though it was slow enough to encourage dancing with a partner, there was a pep to it Wax hadn't expected. He found he quite liked it. It seemed to be able to beat out his frustration, turn it to something more excited instead.
"Why don't you go there next?"
Steris said, nodding toward a distinguished older woman with her gray hair in a bun.
"That's Lady Felise Dumieux, accompanied by her nephew. You've had business dealings with her. She's exactly the sort of person you'd be expected to seek out. I'll refill our drinks."
"Get me a seltzer," Wax said. "I'll need my mind clear for this." Steris nodded, moving off through the crowd as people made way for dancing in the center of the room. Wax approached Lady Dumieux and introduced himself with a card given to her nephew, then requested a dance, which was accepted. Small talk. He could do small talk. What is wrong with you, Wax? He thought at himself as he accompanied Lady Dumieux to the dance floor. You can interrogate a criminal without trouble. Why do you dread simple conversation? Part of him wanted to dismiss it as mere laziness, but that was his response to everything he didn't want to do. An excuse. What was it really? Why was he so reluctant? It's because these are their rules. If I play by them, I accept their games. It felt like he was accepting their collar. He turned to raise his hand to the side for Lady Dumieux to take. However, as he did, a different woman slid into place and grasped his hand, towing him into the dancing and away from the perimeter. He was so surprised that he let it happen. "Excuse me," Wax said.
"No excuses necessary," the woman said. "I won't take but a moment of your time."
She looked to be Terrace, judging by her dark skin, though hers was darker than most he'd seen. Her hair was in tight braids, streaked with gray, and her face bore full, luscious lips. She took the lead in the dance, causing him to stumble.
"You realize," she said, "that you are a very rare specimen. Crasher. A coin shot and a skimmer."
"Neither are that rare," Wax said, "in terms of metal-born."
"Ah, but any twin-born combination is rare indeed. Mistings are 1 in 1,000. Most fairings, even more unusual, and their bloodlines constrained. To arrive at any specific combination of two is highly improbable. You are one of only 3 crashers ever born, Lord Waxillium."
"What, really?"
"I cannot, of course, be 100% certain of that figure. Infant mortality on Scadrial is not as bad as some regions, but still shockingly high. Tell me, have you ever tried increasing your weight while in midair?"
"Who are you?" Wax said, stepping into the dance and seizing back control, twisting her to his right.
"Nobody important," she said.
"Did my uncle send you?"
"I have little interest in your local politics, Lord Waxillium," she replied. "If you would kindly answer my questions, I will let you be."
He turned with her to the music. They danced more quickly than he was accustomed to, though the steps were familiar. The constant intrusion of those brass instruments drove the song, made his steps seem to spring. Why had he mentioned his uncle? Sloppy.
"I have increased my weight while moving," he said slowly. "It doesn't do anything. All things fall at the same speed, regardless of how heavy they are."
"Yes, the uniformity of gravitation," the woman said. "That's not what I'm curious about. What if you're soaring through the air on a steel push and you suddenly make yourself heavier? What happens?"
"I slow down. I'm so much heavier that it's harder to push myself forward."
"Ah," the woman said softly. "So it is true."
"What?"
"Conservation of momentum," she said. Lord Waxillium, when you store weight, are you storing mass, or are you changing the planet's ability to recognize you as something to attract? Is there a difference? Your answer gives me a clue. If you slow when you become heavier mid-flight, then that is not likely due to you having trouble pushing, but due to the laws of physics.
She stepped back from him in the middle of the dance, releasing his hands and sidestepping another couple, who gave them a glare for interfering with the flow of the dance. She produced a card and handed it toward him.
Please experiment with this further and send me word. Thank you. Now, if I can just figure out why there's no redshift involved in speed bubbles.
With that, she wandered off the floor, leaving him befuddled in the middle of the dancing. Suddenly conscious of how many stares he was drawing, he lifted his chin and sauntered off the dance floor, where he found Lady Demu and apologized to her profusely for the interruption. She allowed him to have the next dance, which passed without incident, save for Wax having to hear a protracted description of Lady Demu's prize-winning hounds. Once done, he tried to find the strange woman with the braids, even going so far as to approach the doorkeeper and ask for her. The card had an address in Ellendale, but no name. The doorman claimed he hadn't admitted anyone by that description, which left Wax even more troubled. His uncle was trying to breed allomancers. A woman asking after the specifics of allomantic powers couldn't be a coincidence, could it? He did pass Milan. Square-chinned, standing over 6 feet tall, her masculine body bulged with muscles beneath her tuxedo, and she'd drawn a gaggle of interested young ladies. She winked at Wax as he passed, but he gave her no response. Steris had a drink waiting for him at the table, where she was flipping through pages of her notebook and mumbling. As Wax neared, he noticed a young man approach and try to engage her in conversation, but she dismissed him with a wiggle of her fingers, not even looking up. The man, deflated, drifted away. Wax stepped up to the table.
"Not interested in dancing?"
"What would be the point?" she said.
"Well, I'm going out and dancing, so maybe you could too."
"You are lord of your house," Steris said absently, still reading. "You have political and economic obligations. Anyone who would want to do the same with me is simply trying to get to you, something for which I have no time."
"Either that," Wax said, "or he thought you were pretty."
Steris looked up from her notes and cocked her head as if the thought hadn't even occurred to her.
"I'm engaged."
"Weren't you here?" Wax said. "Largely unknown save to those who pay attention to Ellendale politics. The lad probably didn't know who you were."
Steris blinked very pointedly. She actually seemed troubled by the idea that someone unknown might find her attractive. Wax smiled, reaching for the cup she'd set out for him.
"What is this?"
"Soda water,"
she said. He held it up to the light.
"It's yellow."
"All the rage here, apparently," Steris said, "with lemon flavoring."
Wax took a drink, then nearly choked.
"What?"
Steris asked, alarmed.
"Poison?"
"Sugar," Wax said. "About 7 cups of it."
Steris took a sip, then pulled back.
"How odd. It's like champagne, only not."
Wax shook his head.
"What was wrong with people in this city?"
"I've decided upon our next target," Steris said,
pointing toward a man across the room, leaning against the archway near some tanks of exotic fish. In his 30s, he wore his jacket unbuttoned with a kind of purposeful sloppiness. Occasionally, someone else would approach and talk to him for a short time, then move back out into the crowd.
"They're reporting to him?" Wax asked.
"Devlin Ayres," Steris said with a nod. "Informant. You'll find his sort at any party. He's either one of the least important people in the room or one of the most important, depending upon the secrets you're interested in discovering. He was also on Relure's list."
Wax studied the man for a time, and when he looked back toward Steris, half of his fizzy yellow drink was gone. She looked innocently in the other direction.
"Probably best," she said, "if you approach him alone. His type doesn't like an audience."
"All right," Wax said, taking a deep breath.
"You can do this, Lord Waxillium."
He nodded.
"I mean it,"
Steris said, resting her hand on his.
"Lord Waxillium, This is exactly what you've been doing for the last 20 years in the roughs.
I could shoot people there, Steris.
Could you really? Is that how you solved things? You couldn't get answers, so you shot somebody?
Well, I usually just punch them. She gave him a raised eyebrow. To be honest, no. I didn't have to shoot or punch all that often. But the rules were different. Hell, I could make the rules if I needed to.
Same goes here, Steris said. These people know things that you need to know. You need to either trick them or trade with them, as you've always done.
Perhaps you're right.
Thank you. Besides, who knows? Maybe he'll pull a knife on you and you'll get an excuse to punch him anyway.
Don't get my hopes up, he said, then gave her a nod and walked across the room.
The gates to the Saren New District Cemetery were topped with a crouching statue of the survivor, scarred arms spread wide and gripping the metalwork arch on either side. Marcy felt dwarfed by the statue's looming intensity, brass cloak tassels spreading out in a radial flare behind him, his metallic face glaring down at those who entered. A spear through his back pierced the front of his chest, the polished tip emerging to hang a foot below the center of the arch. When she and Wayne passed beneath it, Marcy felt as if it should drip blood upon her. She shivered, but didn't slow her step. She refused to be intimidated by the survivor's glare. She'd been raised survivorist, so the gruesome imagery associated with the religion was familiar to her. It was just that every time she saw a depiction of the survivor, his posture seemed so demanding. It was like he wanted people to recognize the contradiction in his religion. He commanded that people survive, yet the death imagery associated with him was a cruel reminder that they'd eventually fail in that task. Survivorism, therefore, was not about winning, but about lasting as long as you could before you lost. The survivor himself, of course, broke the rules. He always had. Doctrine explained he was not dead, but surviving and planning to return in their time of greatest need. But if the end of the world hadn't been enough to get him to return in his glory, then what could possibly do so? They wound through the graveyard, seeking the caretaker's building. Evening had fallen and the mists had decided to come out tonight. She tried not to take that as any kind of sign, but it did make the place look extra creepy. Gravestones and statues were shadowed in the churning mists. Some nights she saw the mists as playful. Tonight, their unpredictable motions seemed more a crowd of shifting spirits watching her and Wayne, angered at their intrusion. Wayne started whistling. That sent another shiver up Marcy's spine. Fortunately, the gravekeeper's building was now only a short distance up the path. She could see its lights creating a bubble of yellow in the mists. She stuck close to Wayne, not because she felt more comfortable having him beside her.
Our target is a man named DeChamp, she said. Should be the night gravekeeper and one of those whose ledger entries show regular upticks in income. He's grave-robbing for sure. In fact, this cemetery showed the highest frequency of that, and the ledgers listed it as the place the city pays to take care of unidentified bodies. I'm reasonably certain the Convra's remains ended up here. We just need to find this man and get him to dig for us.
Wayne nodded.
This won't be like the banker, Marcy said, who was reluctant but ultimately helpful.
Really? Wayne said. Because I thought he was kind of a tit.
Focus, Wayne. We'll have to use the full weight of the law here to push this man. I suspect we'll have to offer clemency to get him to help us.
Wait, Wayne said, stopping on the path, tendrils of mist curling around his brow. You're going to flash your goods at him, too?
I really wish you wouldn't phrase it that way.
Now listen, Wayne said softly. You were right about the banker. You did damn good work in there, Marcy, and I'm not too proud to admit it. But authority works different out here in the world of regular men. You bring out your credentials with this fellow, and I guarantee he's going to react like a rabbit. Find the nearest hole, hunker down, not say a word.
Good interrogation techniques
ain't worth beans if you're in a hurry, Wayne said. Which we are. I'm putting my foot down.
He hesitated.
Sides, I already lifted your credentials.
You...
Morrissey started, then rummaged through her purse and discovered that the small engraved plate that held her constable's credentials was gone, replaced by an empty bottle of Siles brandy.
Oh, please. This isn't worth nearly the same as those credentials.
Oh, no, I gave you a good deal, Wayne said, because yours is only a bit of useless metal, which is about what it'd be worth here in this cemetery.
You will give the credentials back after we're done.
Sure. If you fill that bottle in trade.
But you said...
Convenience fee, Wayne said,
then looked up the path toward the gravekeeper's building. He took his top hat off and stomped on it. Morrissey stepped back, hand to her breast, as Wayne ground the hat beneath his heel, then brought it up and twisted it the other way. Finally, after inspecting it critically, he pulled a knife off his metal belt and cut a hole in the hat's side. He tossed aside his duster and cut off one of the straps of his suspenders. When the top hat went back on his head, he looked shockingly like a vagrant. Of course, he was always one step from that, but it was still surprising how much of a difference two little changes could make. He spun the knife in his hand and inspected Morrissey with a critical eye. The sun had set completely, but with the light of the city diffusing through the mists, it could actually be brighter on a night like this than on one without any mist.
What?
Morrissey said, uncomfortable.
You look too fancy, Wayne said.
Morrissey glanced down at herself. She wore a simple sky-blue day dress, hem at mid-calf, laced up the sleeves and neck.
This is pretty ordinary, Wayne.
Not for what we'll be doing.
I can be your employer or something.
Men like this don't open up none if there's someone respectable about.
He spun the knife in his hand, then reached for her chest.
Wayne,
she said.
Don't be so stiff. You want this done right, right?
She sighed.
Don't get frisky.
Sooner get frisky with a lion, Mara, that I would.
He cut the opaque lace window out of her bodice, leaving her with a plunging neckline. Her sleeves went next, shortened by a good foot to above the elbow. He took the lace there and tied it like a ribbon around her dress right beneath her breasts, then pulled the laces on the back of the dress more tightly. That lifted and thrust her upper chest outward in a decidedly scandalous way. From there, he made a few choice slits on the skirt before rubbing dirt on the bottom parts. He stepped back, tapping his cheek thoughtfully, and nodded. Morrissey looked down, inspecting his handiwork, and was actually impressed. Beyond enhancing the bust, he'd cut along seams, pulling out threads, and the effect wasn't so much ruined as used.
Everyone looks at the chest first, Wayne said, even women. Which is kind of strange, but that's the way it is. Like this, nobody will care that the dirt looks too fresh and the rest of the dress ain't aged properly.
Wayne, I'm shocked, she said. You're an excellent seamstress.
Clothes is fun to play with. Ain't no reason that can't be manly.
His eyes lingered on her chest.
Wayne.
Sorry. Just getting into character, you know.
He waved for her to follow, and they headed up the path. As they did, Morrissey realized something. She wasn't blushing.
Well, that's a first, she thought, growing strangely confident.
Try not to open your mouth much, Wayne advised as they approached the hut. On account of you normally sounding way too smart.
I'll see what I can do.
He snapped a branch off a tree they passed, spun it around his finger, then held it down before himself like a gnarled cane. Together they approached the glowing building, a small thatched structure that had a few weathered mist-wraith statues sticking up from its mossy yard. The statues, made in the form of skeletons with skin pulled tight across the skulls, were traditionally thought to ward away the real things, as mist-wraiths could be very territorial. Morrissey suspected the creatures could tell the difference between real and stone members of their species, but of course scientists claimed that the mist-wraiths hadn't even survived the Katasandra in the first place, so the question was probably moot. A greasy little man with a blonde ponytail whistled to himself beside the hut, sharpening a shovel with a whetstone.
"Who sharpens a shovel?" Morrissey thought, as Wayne presented himself,
chest thrust out, improvised cane before him as if he were some grand attendee at a ball.
"And all you," Wayne said, "being the one called Deschamp?"
"Deschamp," the man said, looking up lazily.
Now, did I leave that gate open again? I am supposed to be closing the thing each night. I'll have to be asking you to leave this premises, sir."
"I'll make me own way out, then,"
Wayne said, pointing with his cane stick, yet not moving.
"But afore I go, I would like to make you aware of a special business proposition regarding you and me."
Wayne had exaggerated his accent to the point that Morrissey had to pay strict attention to make out what he was saying. Beyond that, there was a more staccato sense to it, more stressed syllables, more of a rhythm to the sentences. It was, she realized, very similar to the accent the gravekeeper was using.
"I'm an honest man, I am,"
Deschamp said, drawing his whetstone along his shovel.
"I don't have no business or needs to discuss, particularly not at a time of night like this one here."
"Oh, I've heard of your honesty,"
Wayne said, rolling back on his heels, hands on his cane before him.
"Heard it spoken of from one street to the next. Everyone's talking about your honesty, Deschamp. It's a right keen topic of interest."
"If everyone's saying so much," Deschamp replied,
"then you'll know I already got plenty of people with whom to share me honesty. I'm gainfully contracted."
"That don't matter none for our business."
"I do think it might."
"See, it won't," Wayne said, "on account of my needing only one special little item that nobody else would find of interest."
Deschamp looked Wayne up and down. Then he eyed Morrissey, and his eyes lingered, as Wayne had said they would. Finally, Deschamp smiled and stood, calling into the hut.
"Boy! Boy!"
A child scrambled out into the mists, bleary-eyed and wearing a dirty smock and trousers.
"Sir?"
"Go and kindly do a round of the yard," Deschamp said. "Make sure we ain't disturbed."
The boy grew wide-eyed, then nodded and scampered off into the mists. Deschamp rested his shovel on his shoulder, pocketing the whetstone.
"Now, what can I be calling you, good sir?"
"Mr. Coins will do," Wayne said, "and I'll be calling you Mr. Smartman for the decision you just made right here and now."
He was changing his accent. It was subtle, but Morrissey could tell he'd shifted it just faintly.
"Nothing is set as of yet," Deschamp said. "I just like to give that boy some exercise now and then. Keeps his health."
"Of course," Wayne said. "And I understand completely that nothing has been promised. But I tell you, this thing I want, ain't nobody else going to give you a clip for it."
"If that's so, then why are you so keen for it?"
"Sentimental value," Wayne said. "It belonged to a friend, and it was really hard for him to part with it."
Morrissey snorted in surprise at that one, drawing Deschamps' attention.
"Are you the friend?"
"I don't speak ska," she said in the ancient terrace language. "Could you perhaps talk in terrace, please?"
Wayne winked at her.
"No use, Deschamp. I can't get her to speak proper no matter how much I try. But she's fine to look at, ain't she?"
He nodded slowly.
"If'n this item be under my watchful care, where might it be found?" "There was a right tragic accident in town a few weeks back," Wayne said. "Explosives. People dead. I hear they brought the pieces to you." "Bilmy runs the day shift," Deschamp said. "He brought 'em in. The ones what weren't claimed, the city put in a nice little grave. They was mostly beggars and whores. And right undeserving of death,"
Wayne said, taking off his hat and putting it over his breast.
"Let's go see them."
"You want to go tonight?"
"Even it ain't too much a sweat."
"Not much sweat, Mr. Coins," Deschamp said.
but your name had better match your intentions.
Wen promptly got out a few banknotes and waved them. DeChamps snatched them, sniffed them for some reason, then shoved them in his pocket.
Well, those ain't coins, but they'll do. Come on, then.
He took out an oil lantern, then led them into the mists.
You changed your accent, Maris, he whispered to Wayne as they followed a short distance behind.
Aged it back a tad, Wayne explained softly. Used the accent of a generation past.
There's a difference. He looked shocked.
Of course there is, woman. Made me sound older. Like his parents. More authority.
He shook his head as if he couldn't believe she'd even asked. DeChamps' lantern reflected off the mists as they walked, and that actually made it harder to see in the night, but he'd probably need it when digging. It did little to dispel the eeriness of gravestones broken by the occasional twisted mist-wraith image. She understood, logically, why the tradition would have grown up. If there was one place she wanted to keep scavengers away from, it would be the graveyard. Except that the place had its own set of human scavengers, so the statues weren't working.
Now, DeChamps said, and Wayne caught up to listen, I'll have you know that I am an honest man.
Of course, Wayne said.
But I'm also a thrifty man.
Ain't we all, Wayne said. I never buys the fancy beer, even when it's last call and the bartender halves it to the empty barrel.
You're a man after me own heart, then, DeChamps said. Thrifty. What's the good of letting things rot and waste away, I says. The survivor, he didn't waste nothing useful.
Except noblemen, Wayne said. Wasted a fair number of them.
Wasn't a waste, DeChamps said, chuckling. That there was weapons testing. Gotta make sure your knives is working.
Indeed, Wayne said. Why, sometimes the sharp ends on mine need lots of testing, to make sure they don't break down in the middle of a good killing.
They shared a laugh, and Marcy shook her head. Wayne was in his element. He could talk about stabbing rich people all day long. Never mind that he himself was wealthier now than most of Ellendale. She didn't much care to listen to them as they continued to laugh and joke, but unfortunately she also didn't want to get too far away in this darkness. Yes, the mists were supposed to belong to the survivor, but rusts. Every second tombstone looked like a figure stumbling toward her in the night. Eventually, the gravekeeper led them to a freshly filled grave tucked away behind a few larger mausoleums. It was unmarked, save for the sign of the spear, carved in stone and set into the dirt. Nearby, a few other new graves, these open, awaited corpses.
You might want to grab a seat, DeChamps said, hefting his shovel. This'll go fast since the grave is upturned, but not that fast. And you might tell the lady to watch the other way. There's no telling what bits I might toss up.
Grab a seat, Wayne said, looking around at the field of tombstones.
Where, my good man?
Anywhere, DeChamps said, starting to dig.
They don't care none. That's the motto of the gravekeeper, you know. Just remember, they don't care none.
And he set to it.